You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
If you don't mind, I take exception to the term accompanying. I believe that we are pianists.
It's really meaningful that we paint his painting instead of him.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we put the spotlight on the indispensable musicians behind the virtuoso.
You have to find the balance of when to assert your ego and when to lose your ego.
Just one of those things.
We also jump off a building with a stunt woman who's doubled for half the stars in Hollywood.
My job is to keep them safe, to make their action look good.
The pop music impresario Danny Goldberg will be here with me to talk about all of the intricate machinery behind the stars. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. It is always delightful to look back and see that exotic bits of civilization's DNA bloomed spectacularly at particular places and particular times. Paris, in the decade before the First World War, was one of those charmed times and places for painting, as New York was for painting and theater during the decade after the Second World War. Right now in architecture, Los Angeles may be such a ripe locale. The flowering began in the late 90s when Richard Meier finished his impeccable Getty Arts Complex on an L.A. mountaintop. Now, all at once, the city is getting three new buildings by three internationally celebrated architects. All three are public performance venues in a city where architectural statements have been largely private gestures by zillionaires. And the three could not be more different. First to open, literally in the middle of Hollywood, will be the first permanent headquarters for the Motion Picture Academy, a home for the Oscars that we can all watch live on television next month.
And look who's going home with Oscar tonight.
The star of its design team is David Rockwell. He's a New Yorker, but he has an architectural sensibility that is ultra L.A. As designers of restaurants and casinos and sports stadiums, his firm makes architecture that indulges fantasy and sensuality, that tells stories, that entertains. And so the entrance to the new Oscars building is a 40-foot-high movie theater curtain. That is, a giant sculpture of an old-fashioned velvet curtain cast in glass. It's been built, in effect, for just one ritual, one night a year— the high holy day of American entertainment.
And the winner is...
In other words, it's an absurd building, fabulously absurd, as much a cathedral for our recent celebrity-mad era as Notre Dame or Chartres were to the Middle Ages. And just across town in downtown L.A., the real thing is under construction. The Cathedral of Our Lady of the Angels, mother church for 4 million Roman Catholics. It was designed by the Spanish architect José Rafael Muneo, who specializes in a kind of earthy, gigantic, primal modernism. The cathedral is being constructed of concrete, thousands of tons of concrete shaped into a kind of crystalline, surreally solemn fortress, an 11-story high fortress relieved by glowing 6-story high alabaster windows. And a couple of blocks away from there, the city's third new architectural wonder is rising, Disney Hall. Not a movie palace, but the new home venue for the Los Angeles Philharmonic. It's the first major project in his hometown for the world's greatest living architect, Frank Gehry. Disney Hall will be an awesome expressionist blossom of stainless steel. In other words, very reminiscent of Gehry's masterwork, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. But in fact, it's a prequel, to use the movie term. The L.A. Concert Hall was designed a decade ago, before Bilbao. And it will be amazing inside as well. Its seats entirely surrounding the concert stage, a complicated wooden ceiling, and a slightly insane-looking pipe organ designed by Gehry himself. It's terrific that ambitious and unorthodox architecture is proliferating like this in Los Angeles. I think it's happening now because LA is rich and vital, but it's also getting old. Old enough to want to be a major cultural player in that old-fashioned, built-to-last sense. I find these three buildings particularly heartening in our utilitarian, no-frills age. Three public monuments to fantasy, to dreams. Three splendidly unnecessary, magnificently irrational buildings.
Like another perfect day.
Thank you, LA.
I love LA.
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Pretty much everyone in this country, including performers, is thinking differently about national symbols these days. That's certainly part of the draw of a current series of concerts organized by the conductor Leonard Slatkin for his National Symphony Orchestra in Washington, D.C. The Journey to America series features the Star-Spangled Banner at the beginning and end of every program. But Slatkin is not playing the usual orchestrations of the national anthem. Instead, he's showcasing arrangements by 20th century immigrants to America. Susan Scheuer asked Slatkin how he wants audiences to respond.
What we're going to ask our audiences to do here in Washington is to observe the etiquette at the beginning of the programs and stand and sing along. Most of the versions we've chosen to start the concerts are appropriate to that. But then as we present other versions, I'm going to ask them to remain seated and listen for the differences that they might hear between the versions, perhaps even playing an example of one place, either a rhythm or a harmony, that might have been altered. And who knows? Maybe from all this we'll come to have a greater musical appreciation and understanding of our very own anthem.
Each of Slatkin's concerts features two arrangements of the Star-Spangled Banner, as well as other compositions by immigrants. There's Dvorak from Bohemia, Bloch from Switzerland, Toscanini from Italy, Bartok from Hungary, Stravinsky from Russia. His orchestration of the anthem comes with its own story.
What Stravinsky did, he was in his neoclassic mode, so he takes out some of the notes that create the traditional harmonies, and rather than being an elaboration harmonically, in other words, the dissonances are gone, and even some of the triads, the groups of three notes that form the basis of most Western harmony, this disappears as well, and we hear two notes instead, and the space between the notes is made greater, and therefore it's unusual. It's also interesting to remember that when it was first done in Boston, the score and the parts were confiscated after the first performance because the Daughters of the American Revolution felt it was simply too unpatriotic.
Slatkin planned the festival to reflect both the bright and dark side of the immigrant experience. There's a Sheng composition called Lacerations, remembering the Cultural Revolution in China, and just after it in the program is de Rivera's Grand Danson, Grand Dance. And the concerts feature immigrant performers and soloists.
People seem so grateful to have come to the United States. And they either choose to celebrate their new land in a patriotic spirit or to look back, sometimes not with pleasure, on their former homes. We're not shirking away from part of the problems that the composers endured as well. So Arnold Schoenberg confronts part of his past and history in his Survivor from Warsaw, which he wrote while he was in Los Angeles.
The day began as usual. Reveille, when it still was dark. Get out! Whether you slept or whether worries kept you awake the whole night, you had been separated from your children, from your wife, from your parents. You don't know what happened to them. How could you sleep?
In any event, this country of immigrants continues to grow, and as such, its musical legacy and its output also grow. We're looking at works of the past, performers of the present, and perhaps a glimpse of the future.
For Studio 360, I'm Susan Scheuer.
Leonard Slatkin and the National Symphony Orchestra perform the Journey to America series through February 9th in Washington, D.C. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story. We're going to be talking today about the people in the shadows in art and entertainment, the people behind the stars, all the folks whose job it is to assist or advance the person whose name appears on the marquee. Joining me to have that conversation is Danny Goldberg, who has been the guy behind an amazing array of music stars. He's been responsible so far for helping to shape the careers of artists ranging from Nirvana to Bonnie Raitt to Madonna to Hanson to R.E.M. He's managed bands personally, and he's headed giant record labels like Atlantic and Mercury. Right now, he runs Artemis Records, a company he started 2 years ago that releases about 20 albums a year, if albums are still indeed called albums, and we can talk about that. Artemis works with wildly disparate acts, including the pop-rap group Baha Men and the punk metal girl band Kitty. Danny Goldberg, welcome to Studio 360.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you've both managed bands in a very hands-on way, and you've been the head of these big multinational record companies where you have staffs of hundreds of people. Is one of those more fun than the other as a means of working in the music industry?
Well, there are different kinds of fun, and obviously there are different times in your life. I think when you're younger, when I was younger, certainly, all I wanted to do was be a manager. Especially if you're single and you can feel free emotionally to travel all you want, the level of intimacy with the artist is at a maximum in the management relationship. And if you love artists and you don't have any musical talent, which I certainly don't, it's the closest you can come to really directing and shaping and, you know, being part of people. And if you admire and like your clients, which certainly isn't always the case, but if that is the case, that's the most emotionally gratifying, but it's also the toughest lifestyle, because you're in the service business, you're not building up any real equity, you're totally dependent on a few people, and if they get mad at you or change the direction of their career, it screws up your whole livelihood, and you have to travel a lot, which is not great. So when I got married and my wife and I had our first kid, I knew immediately that I didn't want to be a manager anymore, and so for this last 11 years of my life, it's been better to be on the record company side, where I can still use some of the skills, but don't have the physical demands are not as great. But emotionally, there's nothing like management if you like music. That's the closest you are to the creative process.
10 years ago or so, you were simultaneously managing Bonnie Raitt's wonderful and enormously well-deserved comeback, and the explosion of Nirvana into the music scene. Is there a kind of inherent schizophrenia in your job, given those, for instance, two very different musical voices?
No, I don't think it's that. There are some schizophrenia involved in it. The schizophrenia is more in the balance of short-term running of a business, and both for yourself and to the extent that you're representing an artist, and the longer-term environment in which creativity actually can happen. That's the most schizophrenic part of it. The different genres, to me, are not schizophrenic. To me, that's just part of the joy of doing what I do, because, as I say, I don't have musical talent, so it's not like I have a proficiency at one genre and not at the other. That being able to be involved with artists who are distinctive from each other musically makes it just kind of more interesting if you think they're good at what they do. So that's not particularly schizophrenic. That's just the nature of creativity, is no two creative people are the same. But the schizophrenia comes from the clash between the left brain and the right brain.
Do you find yourself these days working with artists that continue to be your age, which is to say closer to 50 than to 20? I mean, the Steve Earls and the world and Ricky Lee Jones and so forth?
Part of the company is that, and those are probably the artists that I am the closest to, would be Steve Earle and Warren Zevon and Ricky Lee Jones, Tom Scholz from Boston, because we are of the same generation, and so I'm really part of their audience. And we also have, you know, frames of reference in terms of both the business and the culture that are the same. With the younger artists, I'm more the businessman whose job it is to explain the business to them. But every once in a while, and the joy of doing it and why it's fun to be 51 and be in the record business is I'll hear a group like Kitty, where the oldest member is 19, and I really can feel for that moment what their 14-year-old fans love about them. And, you know, I was able to feel that in my late 30s, early 40s with Nirvana, and every once in a while I can kind of zone into that place, probably because there's a part of me that's still adolescent. I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing, but in the context of what I do for a living, it's probably a plus. But there's a different relationship with my generation, where I'm more hands-on and more kind of the guy that they might talk to about stuff, whereas with the younger artists, I tend to more be the guy running the company, the more the grown-up guy.
Is it best for you if you like or love the music of the artist whose music you're selling and promoting?
Well, I have to believe that somebody loves it. It's not important that I love everything because, for an artist that's appealing to a young audience, it's not such a great thing to have middle-aged people love it. But no, I don't have to love every record. I have to respect every record.
Who let the dogs out?
I don't know how much you love Baja Man, whose hit, Who Let the Dogs Out, was one of your early huge, huge hits after you started Artemis. Was there a series of steps that you knew how to do to launch that, to become this song that was played in every stadium and on the lips of every kid for several months in America?
Most of what happened, and this is with true of most hit records, about 95% of what happened by itself. And the key was starting the chain reaction. Once the chain reaction, when Nirvana came out, Eddie Rosenblatt, who is the president of Geffen, when asked about the marketing plan for Nevermind, said, "Our marketing plan is to get out of the way and duck." And so the sports thing really kind of happened in a reaction to the fact that the record was already a hit. I mean, we did a mailing to sports teams and hired a sports marketing company because somebody in a marketing meeting said, gee, maybe it would be a sports anthem. So it's one of those ideas that there's a hundred of. It costs very little to do it. Yeah, you know, but we were just incredibly lucky. No other record ever contemporaneous with its success on the radio has become a sports anthem. Usually it's 5-10 years after the fact, like We Will Rock You or something like that.
How does it feel to be a 51-year-old man selling records to 9-year-olds?
It's awesome because I have a 7 and 11-year-old at home, and to do something that my kids get off on is just one of the great perks of the job. I can't do it every year. I can't do it on demand. But, man, when it's happened twice since my kids have been conscious of music with Hanson and with Baha Men, two of the most fun perks of the profession.
So if listeners out there were annoyed several years ago by every child in their household going mbop all the time, I guess you're the man that they should write to now.
Oh, I'm sure they're annoyed about something else by now.
I'm Kurt Anderson talking with the record impresario Danny Goldberg, and in a minute we'll hear from some gifted performers who never get the limelight. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson talking today with Artemis Records founder and chairman Danny Goldberg. And we're looking at the teams of people who are required to turn artists into stars. Every year, hundreds of music students enroll in college and graduate programs in the discipline of accompanying, the art, such as it is, of playing behind somebody else. These unsung collaborators do a lot more than just prop up the soloists, although that isn't always apparent to the world at large. Studio 360's Sarah Fischko finds that it is a complicated world back there.
I've been listening to Backgrounds lately. It all started when I was doing research for a piece on Yasha Heifetz. I'd heard stories about how cruel he was to his accompanist, Brooke Smith, how he'd send him out for sandwiches, for example, and how he made Smith call him Mr. Heifetz, even after a 20-year partnership. So I tried to find out more about Smith. I looked him up in the New Groves Dictionary of Music and Musicians. Nothing. Seems incredible. Nothing on many of the great accompanists. For the next 7 minutes, let's not listen to the soloists. Let's listen to the piano players behind them.
It turned out to be something that I feel that I was meant to do.
It was just one of those things.
Mike Renzi thought he wanted a career as a solo jazz pianist, and then he found himself even happier playing piano behind Mel Torme, Peggy Lee, Lena Horne, Maureen McGovern, Jack Jones.
I even did 8 weeks with Sinatra, one-nighters.
And like all musicians who play with others, he's had to negotiate his way around a lot of different styles and personalities.
There are certain things that you would play for all singers, a bed of music that you would lay down for the same way for all of them.
After that, you individualize.
Let's use Maureen McGovern, for example. Maureen has a fabulous instrument with maybe 4 octaves. I know when she gets up in the higher zone, it was great. It's going to be very gentle, and she takes her time phrasing. So I would play some colors and not a lot of frill. Lena, it had to always have a nice bassy groove, you know, so that more so than with, say, Peggy Lee or Maureen. So what you do is you listen to how they phrase, adjust to what they like, and that's how you do it.
That was Renzi at the piano in all three versions, grappling with the complexities of accompanying.
If you don't mind, I take exception to the term accompanying.
Warren Jones is a distinguished pianist who's played with Håkan Håkagard, Ruth Ann Swenson, Samuel Ramey, some of the most gifted singers and instrumentalists in the field. He has surprised singers and audiences by playing song recitals with the piano wide open.
It was not engineered to be played with the lid closed up any more than singers were meant to sing with socks in their mouth. I believe that we are pianists. We are playing the piano and we are making music equally with our partners. I mean, I can easily play under anybody's volume with lid up, down, or in the middle.
Warren Jones likes to remind people that playing music with others is difficult. Paradoxically, it is in some ways more difficult than playing alone.
Many people who play solo piano music by themselves on the stage, they aim to play beautifully. For this job that we are talking about now, making music with others, that is truly an entry-level skill. You have to be that accomplished just to begin to consider the other aspects of the job, like the balance with some other person, the texture, the voicing. I mean, take your pick. There is an endless, infinite number of considerations that one goes into with every different person that one makes music with. You have to find the balance of when to assert your ego and when to lose your ego.
And that's even before you play a note. Then you have to do what's needed, which is constantly changing.
Well, let's say a song like Death and the Maiden of Schubert. It's a one-page song, and for all of its brevity and simplicity, It is an entirely different song every time a different artist sings and a different artist plays. One looks at the voice singing the piano in an entirely different fashion and plays the textures differently.
We just heard accompanist Jeffrey Parsons, Malcolm Martineau, Martin Katz, and Franz Rupp. Or I should say, collaborative pianists, which is the PC term now for accompanists, especially in schools.
Somebody a few years ago just sort of thought, you know, it's enough is enough. We're collaborators. We're playing. It's not a recital for violin with no piano.
Irma Vallecillo is a classical accompanist who's the chair of the New England Conservatory of Music's accompanist division. 7 years ago, there was one student in the program. This year, 24 students were awarded master's degrees in accompanying.
There is still a stigma attached to it. You know, people who are really, really wonderful solo pianists. What happens when they go into accompanying programs is I think they get frustrated because the rest of the world doesn't see them anymore as so-called good pianists.
Despite the stigma, dedicated pianists love this work. Especially the late, great Gerald Moore, the father of all accompanists, who said, "Some tennis players and golfers prefer singles to the partnership game, but I like partnership. So let the solo pianist have the thrill and glory of playing a lone hand. I shall continue, I hope, to get my musical thrill from collaboration and from the joy that comes from perfect teamwork."
Even if you turn out to be the most fabulous concerto soloist in the world, you will benefit from having played songs with people. I hope that, you know, everyone that has the chance will experience this kind of music making.
If you love what you're doing, it sort of feels like, okay, this is going to be good. And you don't feel like you're doing anything subordinate. You feel like, this is great. I'm very satisfied in making these colors and creating this orchestration, so to speak, underneath the solo line.
So next time you listen to the background, and it will jump right out at you. And remember that behind every Yasha Heifetz, there's a Brooke Smith. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fishko.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking with the music industry muckety-muck and genius Danny Goldberg. He's the founder and chairman and CEO of Artemis Records, which puts out the records of some of my own favorite pop musicians, including Ricky Lee Jones, Warren Zevon, and Steve Earle. Danny, in rock and roll, it must be more difficult for the de facto accompanists in a band, because the band is supposed to be a band and everybody is sort of a nominal equal. But obviously in a band like, say, Nirvana, which you worked with, Kurt Cobain was the star, and those other guys, as fine musicians as they may have been, were effectively his accompanists, weren't they?
Well, every situation is different. I mean, Dave Grohl's done pretty good with the Foo Fighters after Kurt's death, so you'd have to say that he was a little more than just an accompanist. And there are other examples of that. When Genesis started, Peter Gabriel was the lead singer, and the drummer was this guy who never sang ever called Phil Collins. And then Phil Collins ended up being bigger as a soloist after he left the band than Genesis ever was as a group. So there's all different kinds of groups. I was sort of transported listening to the piece about these accompanists, thinking of some of the great session players that have been involved with the kind of music I've been involved with, you know, in some of the L.A. records of the 70s, people like Jackson Browne and Linda Ronstadt. And when I worked with Stevie Nicks, I remember when Russ Kunkel came in to do a drum part on a Edge of 17, it transformed the whole record, and how important he was to her for years and years and years after. And the way Jackson Browne would use Waddy Wachtel for guitar solos. These are not famous people to the public, but really respected and well, you know, by the stars because of what they contributed to the records. When people would talk about going down to Muscle Shoals to make records, some of the great Aretha Franklin records, they weren't going there for the cuisine of Muscle Shoals or for the technical quality of the tape recorders down there, but for the musicians that live there. So it's been a big, big part of pop music. It varies from artist to artist. There are some self-contained acts. Some of them, sometimes the members of the group are famous. Some of them, they're more in the background. But in the making of records, there's a long tradition of very, very important session players that I think are similar in their genius to some of the people that were just, you know, talked about in these other genres.
In the movies, there's a whole army of people behind every star, from managers to stylists to publicists to trainers. And if a movie star in a big Hollywood action movie needs to jump out of a helicopter into a field of fire, they, of course, call in the stunt double. Correspondent Jonathan Mitchell visited a stunt double on a set in Los Angeles. You certainly don't know the name Nancy Thurston, but you do know the people she's pretended to be.
Let's see, Reese Witherspoon, Kelly Martin, Sarah Michelle Gellar, just once or twice, Drew Barrymore, Taylor Dane, Natasha Wagner, she was really nice, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Holly Marie Combs, Alex Borstein, you ever watch Mad TV? Joan Rivers, oh my gosh, I got to double Joan Rivers last year, what a hoot. I had a blast working with Joan Rivers, we had to do a fight scene with another guy, that was really fun. Titanic, got to jump off the ship into the water several times down in Rosarito, Mexico. I had to hang off a fire scaffolding and fall backwards. I had to crash through the banister, hit the wall, and then go into a stairfall. And the car hits me and keeps going. They don't stop. You just never know what you're going to do. One time in a movie called Mean Guns, I had the top of my head on fire. That was exciting. I mean, it's not like you do that every day. It's just something different every day. When I was younger, I saw a high diving show and I thought it was pretty exciting, thought I can do it, because I swam and dove for 20 years of my life. I started when I was 5. And watching movies and seeing stunts, I thought that would be exciting. I always wanted to do that. So high diving was my stepping stone. And that's kind of how I got known, was doing high falls, but there's not high falls in every movie, so I try to practice everything. You know, sometimes you're doing a fight scene, sometimes a stair fall, sometimes you're lit on fire. So the more versatile you are, the better.
So what are we filling up here?
We're filling up an airbag to practice some high falls, and this particular bag is rated to 100 feet, so you can go up to 100 feet and do a fall into it. This particular perch, we have a 20, 30, and 40-foot perch. I'll probably do a couple off the 40. And because it's such a big bag, it just takes a few minutes to blow it up.
So you usually get to meet the people who you double for?
Sometimes. Not always. Like on Charlie's Angels, when we did our big high fall, the actresses weren't there, so I never got to meet her. And sometimes I do get to meet them and work with them. A lot of times, you know, I've asked them, you know, can I take a picture with you? So I have a couple of pictures of people that I've doubled in our wardrobe and our makeup. And, you know, I send copies of those back to my family back in Illinois. They like to know what I'm up to and what I'm doing, who I'm working with. Part of what I consider my job is keeping, like if I'm doubling a particular actress or a kid, my job is to keep them safe, to make their action look good, but keep them free from bumps and bruises. Remember a long time ago I was working on a film and I had to jump from one rock to another, and there was a good 10 or 12 foot gap down, and about a 6 foot gap wide. And even the girl's very athletic and very strong, but you know, what if the rock crumbled, you know, when I went to push off, you know, what if she, you know, broke her leg or hurt herself, and she's, you know, the main character in the movie, it's not just her out of a job, everybody's out of a job for a while waiting for her to heal.
So what happens when you jump on the back, what happens?
There's flaps on the side. I was going to take you around and show you where the air vents are. These, once I hit, will pop open and release some air. So when I hit it, it's like a cushion, and it absorbs my impact, and air is released on either side of the airbag. If you didn't have that, you would bounce, and it would be kind of like hitting a trampoline. And you'll be hearing it when I come down. Don't worry, you'll hear it getting up the ladder. That's the most work out there, is actually climbing up to where you have to go from. It's basically, yes, getting to know people and you know, say if you need somebody my height and my size, please keep me in mind. But, yes, it's all about, you know, networking. Yeah. And it's like a roller coaster, though. There's times where it gets slow. You know, I don't work for a couple of weeks or so. And there's times, like right now, I work on a show called Charmed that I absolutely love. And it's not every week, but it's the season just started again. And I have a day this week. Next week I have two. And it's kind of, it's a surprise every week. You just never know how many days you're going to work, what show you're going to work on. You're kind of constantly on call. And you never know what the coordinator is going to ask you to do. You know, can you, you know, do a high fall at 50 feet? Yeah. Oh, can you do it backwards? Yeah. Can you go through a window? You know? Scream 2. I got to do a high fall in Scream 2. Oh, look, excellent. I'm okay. Get a little gust of wind?
Yeah.
I mean, some things that I do that were really fun or, you know, I'll, you know, definitely call my parents and say, oh, you know, it's going to be on September 3rd. You got to watch this. You know, I got to do some fun, you know, tumbling or get hit by a car. You know, parents love to hear that. Yeah, I got hit by a car. I'll be sure to watch it, Nance. I talk to friends of mine back then. Well, they just kind of scratch their head and they go, you think that's fun? And I go, well, yeah, don't you? And they laugh at me.
All right. Three, two, one, bang!
Jonathan Mitchell produced that story about stunt person Nancy Thurston. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 talking with Artemis Records chairman Danny Goldberg. As we hear pieces like that, and for the last 10 or 20 years, you know, there's more and more media that shows how it's done, whether it is the making of movies or TV or music, are consumers of entertainment becoming too knowledgeable so that the kind of innocent thrill of just seeing the show is diminished?
I was wondering the same thing when I was listening to this piece, and I think of my own kids who were really interested in the behind-the-scenes stuff. I know even on, you know, Disney Channel or Nickelodeon, they'll show behind-the-scenes things on movies. I think it's just somehow part of the way that audiences process it now. I don't think it's diminishing the connection. You know, I think people always sort of knew when they were in a movie theater. I mean, there's that one famous exception of Orson Welles doing War of the Worlds on the radio and people actually thinking the Martians had invaded. But that was, you know, an awfully long time ago. I think people kind of knew that Humphrey Bogart wasn't really a gangster, mm-hmm. You know. So I think that this sort of by it's some sort of a weird breaking of the fourth wall that makes the whole thing a little more intimate. I mean, theater, after all, you know, people for hundreds of years could lose themselves in the theater, even though they knew perfectly well that it was a stage. And so I think that the emotional and artistic elements of it still can make you cry or make you laugh or make you scared. But the understanding of the process somehow makes it more interesting to people. It must, because it's become this phenomenon. When I was growing up, you didn't know all this behind-the-scenes stuff, and now it's just part of the whole way that people learn about entertainment.
You're listening to Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson with the rock music impresario Danny Goldberg. In a minute, we'll go inside an old warehouse where workers on an assembly line are making art. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 talking today with the music industry veteran Danny Goldberg, and we're talking about the creative workforce that exists behind the stars. In the history of painting, the people behind the stars have often been artists themselves. The Baroque master Peter Paul Rubens famously employed an atelier full of assistants who would rough out his work and sometimes nearly finish it. Andy Warhol created forms for his assistants to execute, as does Jeff Koons today. And a young artist named Takashi Murakami is adapting the artist's factory for his own cross-cultural art. Murakami employs 50 artist helpers in two factories, one in Japan and one in America, in Brooklyn, New York, which Studio 360's Steve Nelson visited.
It's hot. I'm in an old warehouse in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. There's no air conditioning. Two young women are hunched over a canvas that's maybe a little bit larger than a card table. They're working on a painting called Time Bomb. The canvas is still mostly blank, but I can see the pink and yellow outline of a mushroom cloud that looks like a skull. Yoko Toshima is using a tiny paintbrush to trace around the edges of the skull.
I'm putting an outline on the skull, so the masking of the outline of the skull will be smoother. The next step is to paint the background by spray by masking the skull in the middle.
The next stop for Time Bomb is the spraying room. 10 coats of black paint for the background, 10 coats of green for the mushroom cloud. The multiple layers applied by Yoko Toshima and her co-workers will produce the flat, shiny look that Murakami's work is known for.
Some of it is very difficult. That one, for example, is not so difficult. But there are difficult ones that are small. And these works are very intricate and elaborate and tiny. It takes a long time and a lot of concentration.
When you think of an artist's factory, you think Warhol. His factory was a hip counterculture hangout. Takashi Murakami's space seems almost plain. Douglas Fogel is a visual arts curator at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. He says there are other differences, too.
The production process has begun to be far more, I wouldn't say mass-produced, because they're not silk screens like Warhol, and that's a photomechanical reproduction process, because they are all still painted by hand. So it's much more like a production process that's similar to a Renaissance master, in a way, that has many assistants working with this person on larger projects.
Last year, the Walker hosted Superflat, an exhibition curated by Murakami of young Japanese artists. Fogel says the factories free up Murakami to work on projects like this. He also uses them to make art that's accessible to a wide audience. The Hereupon factories manufacture T-shirts and keychains of his work, like Mr. Dob, a colorful Disneyfied mouse.
We very much hope to, here at the museum, own everything from a T-shirt to a larger object that we might consider a fine art object, a sculpture or something. And yeah, I mean, obviously in the art world, something that's more rare is going to be worth more in terms of the gallery world, what they want to sell it for. But in terms of like art objects, I consider them, yeah, I consider that just as much a Murakami as a large, unique sculpture.
Today, while Yoko Toshima is working on Time Bomb in Brooklyn, Takashi Murakami is in Tokyo. He's putting together an installation of his work at Tokyo's Museum of Contemporary Art. In fact, Murakami hasn't been to New York in weeks. I reach him on his cell phone at a restaurant. He tells me that he always draws his work by hand first, then completes it using Adobe Illustrator.
Then, you know, send to the email in a data image. We can send to the email. And then Brooklyn studio people can get the image in a computer and print out, then, you know, blow up to the, you know, Kinko's copy center or something like that, and making to the silk screen or, you know, tracing by hand.
I told him that I'd been to his studio, that I had seen Time Bomb in progress, and I told him I felt a little weird seeing his painting before he did.
That situation is, you said, unusual, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But, you know, it is really general. Very good example is, you know, graphic designer, right? So graphic designer making to the, you know, the book, and then they order to the printer. But, you know, final process, you know, graphic designer can see to the sample, and they can check it out. This color is, you know, please making to the a little bit, you know, more, you know, red or blue or something like that. This process is, you know, really, you know, general, I think.
Back in Brooklyn, Yoko Toshima agrees.
For example, in movie making, it's not like only the director does everything, like lighting, camera, and so on. But very much like that, we sign all our names to the back of the panel. With that system, we're making paintings. It's not a problem, and I don't feel weird.
She says she's learning a lot about painting and composition, although right now she isn't working on her own pieces. Kanako Okasaki is another assistant at the factory in Brooklyn. She's studying art at NYU and is an aspiring sculptor.
When I'm working here, I feel like I'm understanding more about his painting. And like, I think it's really meaningful that we paint his painting instead of him. He's a successful artist in the United States and in Japan. And I want to learn like how he approaches like to different audiences. I think it's really helpful for me to see him working in both environments, because in Japan it's really different. The art is accepted in different ways than in the United States.
In a way, it fits into a long tradition of younger artists working with more established ones. Curator Douglas Fogel says that, in the end, this exposure to the art world can lead to personal success.
You get to see their process. You get to be in a context in which your work can not only develop and maybe even supported by that artist, but you get to meet people who know that artist. And with Murakami, I'll say that two of the artists who work with him in Tokyo are actually artists who are now getting picked up by galleries in the States.
And 15 years ago, Takashi Murakami was an artist assistant too. For Studio 360, I'm Steve Nelson.
To see some of Takashi Murakami's images, you can visit our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the music mogul Danny Goldberg. Now, I don't know if you know the work of that artist, Takashi Murakami, but it's very reminiscent of Japanese anime and that kind of illustrative style. And it's very instantly recognizable in a kind of branded way. And I wonder if, in your experience, if that need to sort of put out the same thing over and over and over again to maintain one's success has become more oppressive over the years than it used to be.
I think it's been oppressive for a while. If you study the life of Jimi Hendrix, he was haunted in his later years by pressure from fans for him to dress flamboyantly, which he had stopped doing, and to light his guitar on fire and to do all sorts of gymnastic trips. And he was in the latter years much more into pure music and influences like jazz and blues. So that's sort of a famous example of someone from the 60s that was haunted by that kind of pressure. I think everybody is haunted by their successes, because the success is something you created at an earlier time in your life, but it's alive in the minds of your public right now. And the great successes in entertainment figure out a way to bridge the past, the present, and the future. But it's a real problem. I think it has been a real problem for stars of all kinds today and for many, many, many years. It's just part of the curse of success.
So when an artist like Warren Zevon goes on stage during a concert and somebody from the audience screams out, "Play Werewolves of London," does he do that and play his hit or play it grudgingly?
He certainly plays Werewolves of London in his shows. I think when you're doing a concert, if you're not going to do your famous songs, you really owe it to the audience to say you're just doing your new material or something, because it's almost false advertising otherwise. How grudging it is, I think, varies from artist to artist. I think a rational artist will be really happy that they have some famous songs that keep them being able to make a living over the years. But any creative artist is going to want to make sure that a lot of what they're doing is fresh and new, and that they're not just an oldies act. And like so many other things in life, achieving the balance is the art of that sort of a thing.
Is that part of your job as a manager and as a label owner, advising artists on how to achieve that balance?
Oh, The artists that I like the best and are the closest to are the least likely to take my advice because they have such a clear vision of what they're doing. And if by any chance I ever gave them advice, I would certainly never say what it was. And if by any chance they ever took it, they would certainly never admit it.
As you've said, big public companies need to focus on records that are going to sell millions of copies and can't just afford, by the nature of those institutions, to put out records that sell few copies or copies over a period of time. One of the records that you have out that certainly epitomizes the sort of record that a big company couldn't put out is a rap record by the Harvard scholar and author Cornel West. You wouldn't have put that out at Mercury or Atlantic, I guess.
Well, if I had put it out, it would have been, everybody who runs one of those big companies has a little category of the things they do for themselves. If you're having a good year, it's one of the perks. So I did put out Allen Ginsberg, when I was at Mercury, and I didn't do it because I thought it was going to sell a lot of records. So I would hope that wherever I was, I would be able to work with Cornell when he decided to do this. Cornell's just done this unique thing of amalgamating R&B and some rap and his incredibly charismatic speaking style, which is a combination of Harvard professor and preacher. And, I think it's going to go down like one of the Quincy Jones records as a sui generis, one-of-a-kind masterpiece.
Man, Corn.
Yeah, brother.
You know what I was tripping on the other day? I was tripping on the 70s.
Man, they had some deep sharing and caring and loving and hugging, and the neighborhood was not yet a hood.
I know we had just 8-track tapes and bell bottoms, but man, I think it'd go a little something like this.
Yeah. This is what we talking about.
Yeah.
The old good times.
That Barefoot Farm, brother.
Yeah, they played music. Serious music.
Here we go, here we go.
Hey.
Remembering those 70s, didn't care what life would bring, playing hide and seek every day. When I think about those 70s, music was my destiny, never let my dreams fade away.
Amazingly, that really was Harvard professor Cornel West singing 70s song from his recent CD, Sketches of My Culture.
He was talking, and he doesn't do the singing. Like I said, if you go back to some of Quincy Jones's records, like Back on the Block, Cornel talks on the record and raps a little bit on the record and wrote all of the record, all of the words on the record, but he does not sing. He got some of those unsung session singers that we were talking about earlier to help create the vision, just the same way Quincy Jones has done on his records.
It is amazing that record is the work of one of America's leading intellectuals and a tenured Harvard professor.
And that he would dirty his fingernails with something as seedy as an album. It's really a big boost in the self-esteem for all of us in the record business. He actually came to the convention of our distributor, Red, and talked to all the salesmen there. He's really loves popular culture, and he's one of the few political thinkers and intellectuals who's not a snob about it.
Exactly.
And I think that he can really have an impact with his ideas in a way that a lot of the elite will never have because of that great attitude of his.
Now, you, Danny Goldberg, have been very careful not to upstage your artists and the musicians that you've worked with over the years, but you do and have a sort of significant public persona speaking out for the ACLU and other causes, representing the music industry in the ongoing sort of culture wars in Washington and elsewhere. How do you need to define your own limits about whether how much in the shadows behind the stars you'll remain or not?
I think the biggest issue with that has more to do with the people I work with in business and what kind of a company I'm working for, and because if I'm identified with a company, then what I'm saying is not only me as an individual, but affects this other wider group of people. I've never felt it bumped into my responsibilities or role with artists, but I have felt sometimes that the sort of fun of sounding off in public sometimes came at the expense of the balance between the role I played at a company and the role of some of my less media-friendly colleagues.
If you could have been a rock star and trade in the life you've actually had over the last 30 years for pick your star, Bob Dylan's, Bruce Springsteen's, would you do so?
Oh, man, that's almost a Barbara Walters kind of a question. I don't know. I would sure love to be able to do it, like, for a month, like one of those movies, you know, where you can live another life for a month. And I mean, I like my life the way it is now, so I would hesitate to do anything that would tamper with it. I mean, like my family and everything. But, you know, it's an incredible I do think artists are some of the most special people on the planet, and it would be interesting to know what it felt like to be able to write a song like Bob Dylan or play a guitar solo like Eric Clapton or Mark Knopfler or sing like Aretha Franklin. But I think the most important thing in life is to rejoice in who you are and not to worry about being someone else.
Danny Goldberg, thank you so much for joining me today in Studio 360. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Danny Goldberg is the founder and chairman of Artemis Records. To close the show today, let's hear a little more from Cornel West's CD, Sketches of My Culture, which caused such a ruckus when it came out earlier this year. The track is called Elevate Your View.
Be true to your history, therein lies your possibility. Harriet Tubman, Ida B. Wells, Barnett, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X. The past is prologue to your future.
That's Cornel West, the Harvard professor and fledgling hip hopper. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this has been Studio 360.
Check this out. I used to be just like you. Carry a 9mm just like you. Running around town with a knife in my shoe. On the corner shooting dice while I was drinking my brew. It's true. Until one day I got...
Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Molad,
Andy Lancet,
Amy Jeffries,
Lou Olkowski,
Wayne Schulmeister.
The music is by David Van Tegum. Our Japanese translation was by Hiroshi Snaieri. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the David B. Gold Foundation, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, supporting education, the arts, and culture to enrich community life. Additional funding comes from this and other PRI stations nationwide.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360,
my whole being changed completely simply by changing my personal chemistry.
Altered states.
My experiences taught me something about what it means to even be alive.
Actor and writer Eric Bogosian on drugs and the arts. I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me next time in Studio 360, where art and real life collide, from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.